Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Oral Presentations Podcast, episode 66, How to Bust Up Chip's Card Game by Doyle Brunson. We are going to be taking a look at Texas Hold'em, both limit and no limit, general rules and strategy. And this is based on, my favorite boss I ever had, a dude I worked with like 3-4 years ago named Chip. So, I did overhear, probably accidentally, back when I was working with him, that there was rumblings of a card night. That's all. I heard it down the lane. I don't know how I exactly heard it, but I remember hearing about it, and then I wouldn't stop needling him for maybe 3 months until I forgot about it. I was trying to get a seat at that fucking card game so bad. I just wanted to play. I'm not even very good. I know the mechanics of how Hold'em is kind of supposed to work. And actually, I know it more now because I went through doing this episode. But anyway, I would have loved to sit at that table. Just because of the shit-talking possibilities of it. Now, Chip didn't extend that invite for a number of reasons. I totally understand looking back on it. One, I'm a co-worker and he's technically my boss. You can't have me after hours gambling like that. Also, he knows how much money I make. And you can't, Chip. I mean, I don't know if anybody says it about him, but he's not a bad guy. You know, he's a good guy. I would think that if I was Chip, I wouldn't want to invite this guy to my card game because I know what he makes every week, and I can't watch him lose $500 and then eat ice chunks for lunch for the rest of the week, and be like, and lie to me and be like, I'm on a diet. It's like, no, dude. Me and my friends took all your money in a card game. This is why I can't let you in the card game. However, it's never stopped kicking around my head. You know. A good card game, good time. I don't know how they played. I imagine they played Hold'em. I don't see them playing seven card stud or any of this low ball, anything crazy. I think they just played Hold'em, but I don't know if it was no limit or limit. So for the purposes of this episode, I did both of them because the strategy kind of builds on each other. Now, Doyle Brunson does claim that very rarely do you see high-level players in either no limit or limit because the skills needed to excel at both of them at the elite level are substantially different. However, we are dealing with me here, so I don't really have to worry about either of those problems because I don't expect to be an elite level player at either of these. What this episode is if I was going to go to that game, if I did, by some miracle, a couple years ago, get invited to Chip's card game, this episode it would be what I would have hoped to have recorded for myself so that I could listen to it as I drove to wherever we were going to play for that game. That's the idea of this. I kind of know how Hold'em works. I wanted to go back, and in the idea that, like, let's say he did give me an invite of like, oh yeah, buy-ins. I don't even know what the buy-in was. That's another thing we take into account here. Whether it's limit or no limit, how much money you got to bring, I don't know. I don't even know how much was there. And for the purpose of this being on the internet, there's never been any sort of illegal gambling with anybody I know. This is all just fucking bullshit. However, I don't know how much money there was, but I covered no limit. I covered limit. And just general poker strategy, we're going to go into hand selection here, and I mapped out how I would want to talk to myself as I drove to wherever we're about to play cards with Chip and his friends. I don't really know what's going on there. I mapped out my strategy I would want to listen to on my way there to make sure that my head was as good as it could be going into this game that I definitely don't want to lose. So that's what this episode is. Kind of a weird one, but Super Bowl's coming up, gambling. I mean, pandemic, vaccines getting out there. I would like to play cards live more. I don't know, really know when the hell that's going to go on. You can't really play spades anywhere that I know of. But you can play Hold'em wherever casinos open back up, or I play with my friends sometimes. Because I started playing Hold'em when I was in high school because that was when it got all popular. If you remember, this is a while ago, dude. Like 2004? I was in this basement. I'm sitting at a different place than I used to sit, but it was exactly where I'm sitting that we played cards. And it was because like it started to get popular on TV, and me and my friends were just in this basement playing cards for a while. It was pretty fun, but I mean, it was we were never very good at it. This is where I still own this book. The book that this is all based on is The Super System by Doyle Brunson. It was published in 1978. That's where all this comes from. In no way is this me making up how to play poker in any way. This is from Doyle Brunson's book, and Doyle Brunson is known as the guy who wrote the book on poker, and this is the book. This is Doyle Brunson's The Super System. Now, I didn't go through the whole book. It's a tomb, dude. It has, like, it doesn't have just Hold'em. It has 7-card stud, low ball, ace to 5, deuce to 7, 7-card low, Raz. It's got every game that they used to play for big cash down in Texas or wherever, because this is all pre-World Series of Poker. Doyle Brunson won in 1976. 1977, he won the World Series of Poker. That's way before this shit was on television. The World Series of Poker that Doyle Brunson won was a bunch of dudes who were doing the road, making thousands of dollars, playing cash games on the side at, like, mobsters' places, or like, oh, no, we got held up again. And the beginning of the book is all really interesting stuff, because Doyle Brunson goes and charts through, like, all right, when he was young, he was always super competitive. He was always competitive. So much so that he almost went pro in basketball. He was very good at basketball, but working a side job during, so I think he was 18, or he was 17 or 18, he was working at a sheetrock place or a gypsum sheetrock place, and so he went to go, he had a work accident, dude. He went to go stop, like, 2,000 pounds of sheetrock, and he used his one knee to I gotta put this here, I'm not really thinking about it, crushed his knee, man. And it says in the book, he talks about it, because he talks about where his competitive streak comes from, and he traces it back to when he was a kid. He was competitive at everything, man, especially basketball. He's a multi-sport athlete, played baseball, whatever you want, and then he blew his knee out, and he's like, God damn it. But he transitioned that competitiveness, and one of the big parts of his super system, especially for No Limit Hold'em, is his competitiveness, and it fuels his attention to detail. Again, the theme of this episode is that, like, I'm listening to this as a prepper to go play cards against Chip. Chris, you already know this, but there's a lot of parts of this game that you are not naturally good at, all right? We're going to go through attention to detail. We're going to talk about patience. We're going to talk about strategy. The number one thing you are not doing when you run into this game with Chip and all his people, you don't even fucking know any of these people, is speeding around. We're not playing loose. We'll get into our exact strategy in a second. But discipline and hand selection is where we're coming from. We'll get into it. Also, Doyle Brunson didn't just write the super system himself. So he won the World Series of Poker in 76 and 77. This book comes out in 78. Doyle Brunson went around and he found the highest level experts that he knew, because it was a big club, but it was also a small club, because everybody knows, all the champions know each other. So Doyle won 2 years in a row, and that's where he went and got, I mean, we're also going to talk about Bobby the Al Baldwin did the limit portion of this that we're going to hit on. But their strategies are relatively similar, just different twangs to it, but I'm not even going to get that deep into it. But this isn't just Doyle Brunson. He wasn't like a master of every game, which he goes into in the book. His game was No Limit Hold'em. He thought that was a Cadillac of card games. He loved it. But he would also go and play lowball or fucking 7-card stud or whatever if there was a game around, because there's a whole part of the book where he talks about, like, the poker economy. And he was like, well, if I can't find a no-limit game or, like, a $1,000 limit hold'em game, and they're playing 7-card stud or even 5-card draw or something, whatever, Doyle would sit down at that table to be able to move the action, to be able to be seen as an action player. So then when those guys see that there's a no-limit table going, even if Doyle's crushing, he's got all the chips, they've seen him give up action at a game that they know that isn't his number one game. He talks about the idea of having, like, a gambler's reputation, like, have it be good for the gambling economy. I don't know how much of that is still applicable, because now it's all computers and the internet and stuff. But it gave, like, a cool natural flavor to the world, a cool flavor to the world. Like, you know how, like, sometimes you go see I went and saw the latest Aliens movie with a couple of buddies. And I don't really even like sci-fi that much. I just like that, like, it's a whole world. When you go see that Aliens movie, I forget which one it was, but the way it opens up, that's what I enjoy about it. A good sci-fi movie makes you wonder, like, what is the cook making for dinner tonight? And I don't even see the kitchen, but I'm thinking about, like, all right, what kind of, do they make lasagna on here or what? Like, that's what I enjoy about sci-fi movies, and that's what I enjoy about this book, too, because Doyle Brunson painted a whole picture of, like, way pre-on-TV poker. Just, this was a weird vocation that some hyper-competitive dudes found, and they got so good at it. And then he talks about running and gunning with a couple of his friends, and then how that eventually broke up because they became, like, a Triforce for a minute, and then they all went to Vegas and busted the fuck out, and they were like, Doyle Brunson was like, there's nothing more miserable, because the three of them went and lost, like, $100,000. And this is $100,000 in, like, 1960, and they were all together, and they were like, that's where we broke up. That's where we had to stop playing together. But there's more boring things you can read in the beginning of Doyle Brunson's The Super System. And the whole book is really interesting because there are like narrative parts that set the world at the beginning, and then as you get into each game, like there's no, it's no bullshit. Like there's an expert in every one of these games. Doyle Brunson either wrote it himself or went and got the best guy he knew, and he talks about how he went and procured the talent that were going to write these chapters, because he sat him down and was like, "Hey man, what's up? I need you to write a chapter on Hilo. Now, I don't need you to write a chapter on Hilo if you're keeping anything secret. I want you to pour everything out of your head that makes you one of the best Hilo players in the world. I need you to put that down. I'm going to put this in my book and I'll pay you for it." And if people didn't want to do it, he didn't have them write that chapter. He only got the guys who were willing to be as generous as possible with their cards knowledge and wanted to buy in on the project. And that's what Doyle Brunson, the super system, is. I don't know how much the book is now. I bought it in high school with money I made in cash working at Joe's Pizza. It was like one of the first things I ever ordered off Amazon. I have no idea what this book costs now. You could probably get an ebook of it, but I like having a big, it's a huge book, man. Like the front's ripped off it and shit, but it was nice to be able to crack it back open. I see my little kid underlines I did when I was like 16 being like, "And here you go when they let you in the Trump Taj Mahal, but by then you'll be making millions." It's like, nah, dude. You're going to refound this book in 17 years and do an electronic book report on it about if you ever got invited to your ex-boss's card game, how would you try not to screw it up? But I like it. I like cards. Is fun. Cards has always been fun for me. Even when we were playing it when I was in high school and we were kind of getting into trouble. One of like the all-time getting yelled at by my dad happened down here because we were getting a little too loud, a little too rowdy, a little too often. And I remember he came down because I asked my buddy, like, "Yo, what do you remember about us playing cards?" And immediately he was like, "You got to tell about the time your dad came down." And so he came down. We were screaming. And there had been a couple of Chardonnays going around where there shouldn't have been. So he comes down and he just points at us. And, you can't scream this at little kids. But he was like, "All right, I don't want to hear anymore. Fuck yous." Dude, we fell out laughing. It was one of those like, "Yo, you not to say, your dad just said, fuck you. Your dad just said it. It doesn't care if he's yelling at us or not. Oh my God, dude." It was kick each other under the table and bite your own teeth with an extra set of teeth you better grow. Because you can't laugh at him. He just said no more fuck yous, okay? You got to take that seriously. But I forgot that laugh. Also, I forgot that we had to make a rule eventually when we were playing cards down here that the only thing you're allowed to do in these bathrooms is number one. You can only pee down here, and I forgot why that happened, and my buddy reminded me of this. We made that rule because one time my friend came over, and he clogged the downstairs toilet with just body. I don't really want to go into that more, but he didn't need any help. He clogged an American toilet with good pipes just by him. I still know this guy. He's married. He just had a kid. I'm so proud of him. I also remember when you demolish the downstairs toilet, dude, right? So he puts a hurting on that thing. We're down here playing cards. We don't know what's happening. I think I remember he came down laughing because the guy has a good sense of humor. He knows this is funny, but what are we going to do, dude, right? So he comes down. He's like, "I think I clogged the toilet." And I think this was the same day he had a huge blue Slurpee. So we go back upstairs to see this, like, abomination, dude. You made a mess, right? And it's like, don't try to flush it again, man, right? And so the same kid tries to go and like pivot. Well, at this point in time, like the family's been called in to try to solve this. So the kid's got a huge blue icy. We just got beige carpet. Somebody's dealing with his mess already. He goes and turns to like walk another direction. We just got beige carpet. That it looked like he threw that blue Slurpee. I don't know how that kind of trip happened. But I remember the Slurpee fell in a diagonal direction like it was a huge arrow put on that carpet. And so in the span of like 12 minutes, this kid had turned the downstairs of a house that with an unclogged toilet and nice new beige carpets into like, you know, diarrhea mess and then blue arrow. That was the closest anybody ever came from getting banned from this house, I think. Because I got in trouble a decent amount, so like, nobody's really throwing around bands or anything. It was always like, "All right, well, safe, whatever." But it was like, "Yo, you hit a hard two up there, and then you just put Slurpee all over the place, dude." Also, why are you drinking Slurpee? There's obviously something wrong with your body chemistry. No more Slurpees in that thing, dude. No, I don't know what's going. You got some probiotics or something? It was like 2004. Nobody even knew about that shit. But somebody should have called him on that Slurpee. Like, "Yo, no more treats. Stop eating Lifesaver mints like they were candy." Anyway, so a lot of fun memories as far as cards go, but I never really got good. We were always just playing for fun. And then when we became legal age, it was like, I don't want to go to a casino. We did that a couple of times, but I don't know. Cards is fun, and I wanted a refresher on it. Gambling coming up. Maybe we could play more live cards. The pandemic blows over. But either way, hypothetically, if I was ever playing with Chip's card game, this is the strategy I would go, and it's based on Duel Brunson. All right, also, if you don't know anything about Texas Hold'em, I am going to go over the basic mechanics of how this works, because I have some friends who just never played, and it's fine, but it's I would really like some of those guys to like be able to play more, and a couple of them like halfway it and stuff, and it's not that you're going to learn from this, but just to cover the basics. I also asked my sister, and she was like, oh yeah, I don't know anything about that. Just go over the basics of it so I can kind of follow along. I was like, all right, nice. Well, I was going to do it anyway because I kind of forgot how many rounds of betting there were and stuff like that. Just easy stuff you forget if you're a shitty poker player, which is where I'm at. So let's have a refresher course. Why not? Episode 66, How to Bust Up Chip's Card Game by Doyle Brunson. All right. Basic limit hold'em game mechanics. All right. Now, you're sitting around a card table. Every player gets dealt two cards. They're your own cards. Nobody else sees these cards. And that goes around the table. Let's say you're sitting at a table with nine people. And one of the person's the dealer. We don't have a separate dealer for this. For this example, and for all examples moving forward, one of the players in the game is the dealer. This is also how I've played forever. Maybe nobody's bought a dealer, and I don't play a casino as much. So it's always, if you're playing, you shuffle the deck, or maybe you got two decks going to make it faster. But if you're playing, you're going to shuffle a deck, and you're going to deal it out. All right. So if you're just playing, you're not dealing. Sitting there, you're at a table with nine other people. The direction moves to the left. So let's say I'm the dealer, which is also I'm the button. This is important for position in a second, but a synonym for dealer is button here. So I'm going to deal everybody two cards to the left. Now, if you're at the table, congratulations, you got your two cards. Cool. After everybody gets two cards, or maybe before cards are even dealt, there has to be an obligatory amount of money thrown into this pot. Now, this could be a couple of different ways to do it. There's something called an ante, where everybody playing, no matter what the position in relation to the dealer, throws in a nominal amount of money. Let's call it a buck. You throw in a dollar chip. Everybody has to ante in. So you got nine people at the table. Everybody antes a dollar. There's already $9 at stake in that pot before the hand even really begins. Now, if you want to put blinds on top of that, which is just another way to get money in the pot before anybody even starts playing, a way to stimulate action. So let's say at this table of nine, we got a dollar ante. So every time a hand gets dealt, you got to throw a dollar chip in. Doesn't matter where you're sitting. And also, let's say the guy to the left of the dealer immediately will make him small blind. And then the guy to his immediate left will make big blind. So if I'm dealing, I owe the ante, no other blinds. The guy to my immediate left, let's say he owes $2. Let's say the guy to his immediate left owes $4. So everybody throws in an ante. That's $9. Dude to my left owes $2. Dude to his left owes $4. So we automatically already have $15 in the pot before anybody's bet anything. This is with a blind system and an ante system. Normally when I play, we only play small blind, big blind. But I found the ante system here. So in order to demonstrate that, like, you got to get, like, there's money in the pot before shit even starts going. Let's say we play with an ante, a small blind, and a big blind. Now, the big blind positions rotate as well as the dealer positions. In this example, I'm dealing the cards. The cards go out to the left, and then to my left is small blind, and then to that guy's left is big blind. Now, after this hand is over, I will pass the deck of cards to the person who used to be small blind. In that person will now become dealer. That person will deal out the next hand. And now they don't owe a small blind or a big blind. They still got to pay ante the same way I had to pay ante. But now their dealer, their position has moved. So now the guy who used to be big blind, who's right next to him, now only owes $2. And the guy next to him is now big blind, owes $4. It's just a way to get that $15 into the pot so we can stimulate a little bit of gambling here. So, you know, everybody's just not folding on $3 pots. Now, dealer position is important. We'll hit this more, especially once we get into no limit hold'em. But those positions, the idea that, let's go back to I'm dealer, small blind's next to me, big blind's next to him, everybody's anteing up, okay? That's the same order that we're going to go around for people deciding whether or not they want to call that $4, which is the big blind, or they want to fold their hand. Now, that's based upon your own personal judgment of whether or not the cards you get suck. And everybody ranks them differently. But, demonstrating the importance of position here, if I'm still the dealer, I am the last to act. It is the most powerful position at a poker table. If you are the button, if there's like a dealer, then there's going to be, it looks like a hockey puck thing that they slide around to be able to tell the rest of the table who's the button or who's in dealer position, because that person has the strongest amount of leverage power based upon their position at the table, because they are the last one to act on every round of betting. So if you're in last position, it also comes into play when you're dealing with hand selection, when we're about to get into. If you're in the dealer spot, you have a lot of leeway, and you can kind of open up your hand selection a little bit, because especially in no limit, where cards are worth even less. In limit hold'em, you kind of got to play mechanically, according to Bobby Baldwin. Again, these aren't any of my thoughts, but in no limit, if you have dealer position, I mean, listen to me getting excited about it now. This is why I would bust out if I actually play with Chip. You hear how excited I am to be dealer position in a no-limit game? It's because you're last to act, so whatever anybody else did, they don't know what your cards have, and you can raise anybody. And if it's no limit, you can put all of your money in there and make people have to do things. Man. Anyway, you hear how quickly I will bust out of a no-limit game if I get going, get excited? Anyway, we've just dealt the first two cards at this point in time. Let's say I'm dealer, small blind to my left, big blind to that person's left. Everybody threw a buck in. We got 15 bucks in. All right. Ante and blind structure dictate the pace of play. So if you were going to have like a $2 ante, where now there's 18 bucks automatically, and you're going to raise those blinds to $4, $8, the higher the initial cost to play a hand dictates how fast a game you're going to be playing. So if it costs a shitload of money, if you're paying $5 an ante, and then let's say it's 8 and 12 for small and big blind, you really got to think about playing some marginal caliber hands as far as starting hands go. We're about to get to starting hand position or hand selection, which will be the cornerstone of our game when we go to blow up Chip's poker game. We'll get into why in a second. But the ante and blind structure, how much it actually costs you to see a flop, which is the first three cards that come out, that's going to dictate how fast and how loose you are with your hand selection. So if it's cheap to play, let's say you only are doing small big blind, we got 2-4, and there's no ante, you can kind of hang back a little bit and wait until those kings and queens, ace king come in. You can kind of chill, because it doesn't cost you a lot to just sit at that table and be patient. If there's a heavy ante, heavy blind structure, you really got to think about getting in there a little bit more often than you would like, because you got to gamble a little bit, because if not, it's going to salt away your stack and you're going to be out of chips before you even played anything. All right, so let's say you have your cards, you paid your $4, you got to match the big blind to play. All right, you're in there. Let's say everybody pays. It's a party. Everybody's in, right? So dealer says, all right, money's good. First three cards come out. They get flipped face up in the middle. They are community cards. This is what makes hold'em so complicated, is because all of the players get your own two private cards. And then by the end of the hand, there will be five community cards in the middle of the table that you can use in any way you see fit to make the best hand possible to be able to claim all that money in the middle by the end of it. Now, there's ways to win without showing your cards, but we'll get into those when you get into no limit more, because things get kind of crazy. But for the point of this, let's say three cards come out, a round of betting ensues. Also, position's still really important. I'm the dealer, I'm going last. Fourth card comes out. This is called Fourth Street. So now there's four community cards out there. Let's say a couple people folded because they're not getting what they wanted. Another round of betting ensues. Fifth Street, or the River card, comes out. This is the last card. So at this point in time, you have five community cards out. This is the last round of betting between whoever's left in the hand. After that round of betting's over, if both players are still in, they show down the cards, see which one has the highest five-card hand. Given their two pocket cards and the five community cards, whoever has the highest hand wins the pot. That's the basics of hold'em. I hope I did an okay job at that. Now, this is for limit hold'em. Also, the bets, the blinds we talked about. So 2-4. So in limit hold'em, the big difference that I understand from reading the two chapters of the book or rereading them is that in limit hold'em, where your bets are structured, where let's say there's an ante, a small blind, a big blind, there's a mandatory amount of money or whatever. it's more advantageous to play a disciplined game that's almost mechanical in no limit, or in, I'm sorry, in limit hold'em, because the bet amounts are set. Because it's going to be harder for you to push anybody else off any of their hands. Because what you're looking to do is bluff. You can get people to fold. You only have to show them your cards. You just won that money. Now, it's harder to do in limit hold'em because the bets are set. So the maximum amount of money you can try to push somebody off a hand with is like $4, $8. You can re-raise them, check raise them, try to put pressure on them. But in limit hold'em, it's only going to cost your opponent one or two units, if you, or one or two bets, whatever you want to call them, to be able to see your cards at the showdown and look you up and see, looking you up is them paying to see your cards at the end. And especially early on in the game, which I have a note down here, if I was ever to sit a chips card game early on, set a timer for a half hour, we're not doing anything. We're just going to sit there, you set an alarm on your phone, and you watch. You fold hands, you fold all your, unless you got aces or kings, ace king, I'm setting a half hour timer, and I'm folding everything, I'm putting my phone away, no booze, which we'll get to, no booze, because part of this game, especially if we're playing no limit, is watching how everybody is. The cards are important, especially in limit, where it's only 2-4, and you can't really back people off, but when you get into no limit, that's gambling, and according to Doyle Brunson, that is when you're playing people in position almost as much as you're playing cards. And in Doyle Brunson's opinion, people in position can be more valuable than the actual cards you're dealt in a no-limit hold'em game. Now, whether it's limit, no limit, let's go through what type of hands you can have to be able to win the pot. Just in case you're, I mean, I honestly need a refresher on this too. I mean, off the top of my head, I remembered a few of them, but as far as the order goes, let's go from shittiest hand you can't believe you won a pot with to the best hand possible in poker. Okay, so the worst hand, if no, everybody just checks everything down. Oh, I should probably explain that. So when there's a round of betting, you can either bet or raise. If somebody's already bet, you can raise that bet. You can check if there's been no action, which means you just, you tap the table and you're like, I'm a chill for a sec. I'm cool to keep going, but I'm not putting any money in. I'm also not trying to get anybody else to put any money in. I'm talking free card. I check. Or you can fold. I'm pretty sure you're allowed to fold if nobody even bets. You can just throw your hand away. But, like, probably don't. But if somebody else bets, you can fold. So those are the three actions you can take on a bet. I think I skipped over that. Anyway, the types of hands you can have to win a Texas Hold'em hand. All right. Shittiest one you can have that I can't believe you won this hand. Oh, my God. High card. This is when you have none of, you have no, nothing. You don't have any pairs, you don't have three of a kind, no flush, no full house, no nothing. All you have is a single card. It's the highest card you have. Let's say you have an ace, way to go. That's all you have. It doesn't match with anything. It doesn't go with anything. You can't pair, nothing. You just have an ace. That's your high card. Sometimes that's enough. If nobody has anything, that can win a hand. Congratulations. I can't believe you got away with that one. Now, step above a high card, and it can beat a high card, is your basic pair. This is when you have two cards of the same kind, for example, two aces, and the hand is filled up with the three highest cards that are left available. Now, this is important because if you have a pair and the other person has the same pair, then you're going to look at those three remaining cards because you're looking at kickers. Now, that's, so you're looking to make the best five-card hand possible out of your seven cards that you have available to you. You got your two pocket ones, it was just for you, and then you got five community cards. Out of those seven, you're looking to make the strongest five-card hand possible. So if you're going to show a pair at the end, good luck, number one. Two, that's only two cards. The other three highest cards available, whether they're community cards or they're one of your cards that you have in your hand, those are your kickers. And that will go down to tiebreakers if somebody else has the identical pair. So if I have a pair of eights and another dude has a pair of eights, but I have an ace, I had ace eight when I started, and let's say the board has like a king, jack, queen, a bunch of high shit on it, but it doesn't have an ace. If I show down with this other dude who we both have eights and I had an ace in my hand, I win the pot because I had the higher kicker. Because when we go and we parse up the seven cards available to us, his two and the five in the middle, and my two and the five in the middle, and both of us go to make the strongest hand possible, our first two cards on both of our hands are going to be that 8-8, and then the rest of our three cards will be the highest cards available. Now, he will only have what's on the board and the other shitty card he's got in his hand. I had the ace in my hand, and I have what's on the board. So my ace kicker, bring me that money down, Chip. So I'll go ahead and collect that. That's two pair. That's a pair. Two pair, pretty similar to a pair, except you got two sets of cards that are the same kind. For example, two kings and two queens. Now, same thing with a pair, but this time you don't have three kickers. You only got the one. So you got two pair, and then you have the one highest card aside from those two pair in the event that you go up against somebody else with an identical two pair, but I don't even know if that could ever happen. But as far as ranking your two pair hand goes, if you have aces and eights, let's say there's a jack on it where you have a jack, that's your kicker. If somebody else has aces and eights and a queen kicker, they got you. They took all your money. Above two pairs, three of a kind. This is when three cards of the same kind, for example, three aces. This hand is completed with the two highest cards that are available. So again, you're looking for three of a kind. Let's say you had pocket sevens and a seven comes out on the flop. You just tripped up sevens. You got a set of sevens. That's all right. You might be able to win with that. Also, if the board pairs off, nobody knows you tripped out those sevens. So if the board pairs off on something else, then you got a full house very sneakily. You might be able to make a bunch of money there. That's three of a kind. But if you just have three of a kind, it's referred to also as a set sometimes. You're looking at your kickers, your remaining two cards. Above three of a kind is a straight. This is when you got a series of five cards that follow each other, but they are not the same suit. Aces can follow a king or start a straight followed by a two. So you get the low straight, which is also commonly referred to as the wheel, which is ace, two, three, four, five. Or you can have the high straight, which is ace, king, queen, jack, ten. Wait, did I fuck that up? Ace, king, queen, jack, ten. No, I did not. But also, the low straight is the wheel. The ace counts as like the number below the deuce. So you go ace, two, three, four, five. Is that it? Ace, two, three, four, five. Yeah, that's wheel. Man, watch that be wrong. I don't even know what the fuck I'm talking about. Anyway, so a straight, and also people draw out the straights. We're going to talk about drawing out to a hand versus playing a big hand in a second. But above a straight, and again, that's five cards in sequential order. So deck of cards, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, jack, queen, king, ace, of clubs, diamonds, hearts, and spades. Woo! Off the top of my head. Man, I got worried. I just did not remember what a deck of cards was. Anyway, so a straight, you're looking, and they don't have to match suits, but that's, they have to be in sequential order like that. And it can be ace, two, three, four, five, or you start with an ace up top and you go down to 10. But that's a straight. Above a straight, you're looking at a flush. This is five cards that are all the same suit. They don't need to be in any order. If two players have a flush, the player with the highest card flush wins. So if I'm holding two hearts and you're holding two hearts and the flop comes out, heart, 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 we both have a flush. Now the question is, who has the higher flush? Also, maybe let's say you have one heart and I have two hearts, and let's say I have a low-level flush, and I see that you're chasing a flush, you need another heart to come out. I may try to bet big with my baby flush to get you out of there, because I don't need you drawing a bigger flush, because if I try to see my baby flush all the way down to the river, and you make your bigger flush, you're going to take all my money, dude. That's the thing that Doyle Brunson talks about, where it's like, you know, play a mediocre hand strong, because if somebody's going to make you get off it, they're going to make you get off it, because if you see a mediocre hand all the way down because you can't get away from it, you might lose all of your money. He also says in the book that, like, if that happens, yo, dude, that just happens. It's all right. You know, that's going to happen to you, which I like about the tone of the book, where, like, he sets down rules, he shows you what's going to happen, he tells you it's also probably definitely going to happen, maybe gives you an instance where it happened to him and he lost like $30,000 in 1960, and then he moves on. Really happy I went and found this book again. Anyway, that's a flush. Full house is above a flush. A full house is a combination of three of a kind with a pair. The full house hand that has the highest three of a kind wins from other full houses. Now, I've forgotten this rule before, and I've had to look this up on my phone while playing cards with other people. The three of a kind dictates how big the full house is. So if two people have a full house, and one has three of a kind with sevens, and one has three of a kind with fours, the three of a kind with sevens is a bigger full house. I have forgotten that on live play before, but that is how you judge it by the trips. Above a full house, you got four of a kind. It's exactly what the name says. somehow somebody managed to either have a pocket pair and then two of the same card came out on the flop or the river or 4th Street. Four of a kind. I've only seen this like once in my life in live play. Maybe more than that, but I saw it once when I was playing in 2016, and it was like the remote control turned into an animated Pixar character and started dancing around. I was like, what the fuck? You never see that, dude. I don't even know if I lost money in that hand. I remember seeing it being like, oh, that shit is rare. So above four of a kind is a straight flush. This is the second best hand in the game, just like a straight, but all the cards are also the same suit. I don't know if I've seen one of these. But, and it doesn't have to be, I mean, the next hand up is the best hand you can get, and that is a royal flush. Nothing beats a royal flush. This is the best hand in poker, and it's very rare. It's a straight flush from ace to 10. So you got the 10, you got the jack, you got the queen, you got the king, and you got the ace, all the same suit. It's almost impossible to, I mean, I don't see it often. I mean, I remember seeing four of a kind one time, but the best hand you can get in poker, and in hold'em, you'd be using your two cards plus the community cards to be able to make this, is a royal flush, which is a straight flush at the highest end from ace to 10. So that's what we're going for. Now, let's talk about hand selection as we arrive at chips, because Chip knows I'm a show pony, so our strategy for this, based upon what I read in Doyle Brunson's book, is that we are playing solid fundamentals, because it's the last thing he would expect if I got invited to this card game. He knows I like to joke around. He probably thinks I'm a loose player, and this is why if I was to think to make this like, yo, don't screw this up guy that I would listen to while I was driving to the car or driving to the game, our number one strategy is fundamentals, and it all starts with hand selection. All right, now, with Texas Hold'em, whether we're playing limit or no limit, there's 1,326 possible two-card hands to have in Texas Hold'em. And these are your personal little two-carders. We're not worried about the community right now. Now, as far as our two-carders go and all those combinations, we only care about a handful of them. Everything else is trash, especially if we're playing at that game. We are being very patient with what we choose to spend our time dealing with and entering into play with. So, and it also, what we're going to choose to play, especially if we're playing no limit, which I don't know if they're playing or not, it's going to have a lot to do with the dealer position. But just real quick, let's talk about our very picky hand selection if we were to sit down and play in this game. And now we're assuming that, let's say it's a limit game, and there's 8 to 10 players, full table. Now, the two card combinations that I would be looking to play, if we're going to screw down, be patient here, and look to not embarrass ourselves, and try to make a little bit of money, try to show we can play some cards here. Now, what we're looking to play, and this is, we're looking at suited combinations here. We'll do suited first, and then non-suited. So, cards that we're going to lead with, and that means I can bet in any position. Obviously, pair of aces, pair of kings, pair of queens, pair of jacks, pair of tens, pair of nines, pair of eights, pair of sevens. We'll also go ace, king, king, queen, ace, jack, king, jack, queen, ten, jack, nine. If it's suited, and also, I mean, I'll be judicious with this. If I'm not feeling it, I am also going to play on some voodoo. This seems like a lot of hands I'll be playing. And just maybe I've worked myself up into a little bit of a panic at the idea of actually playing in here. And this sounds like a lot of hands. They're all good hands. Some of them are trouble hands. But this, I'm telling you, we're only playing big cards if we're sitting at this table with Chip and whoever else is there. Now, hands we're absolutely going to throw away. I mean, jack 2, 9 2, 8 2, 7 3, 7 4, queen 5. I don't care if they're suited or not. Throw this shit away, Chris. You are going to lose so much money. Throw them away. And we'll get to why in a second, but unless it's a really good, we're looking to play good hands only. Because when we get in, we want to be able to play. Don't give me this marginal shit. Now, as far as offsuit hands go that I'm going to be looking to play here, ace-king, king-queen, ace-queen, king-jack, king-ten, maybe. And then after that, we're really going to look at position. I mean, really going to look at position. Or, I mean, suited cards are worth a little bit more. I can absolutely get seduced into like a 9-10 suited if I'm in late position here. But I don't like to think about that because that'll be me losing discipline. But I don't know. It's gambling. I will get caught up, especially if we're playing no limit. I got late position. We'll get to it in a second. But for the point of if this was a guide for me to listen to before I go play cards and chips, we are, dude, screw down on hand position. It's not that you can't, on hand selection. It's not that you can't play. It's that you need to really pick what hands you're playing, because when we're in them, we are playing like an asshole. That's our whole strategy here. That's what the book told us to do, but you got to have good hand selection first so you can bulletproof it as much as you can, because once we get into a hand, whether it's, if it's no limit, we're really going. If it's limit, you can only go so hard, but you don't let anybody back you down. That's what I forgot about this book. All right, let's go to our overall strategy. First off, no booze, no phone. Okay, when you're in, set that timer. You got to watch everybody. And, I mean, they'll probably be playing with chips. Don't let them play with cash. Don't play at a game with cash because it's hard to count out. Also, it may freeze up players if there's a decent-sized bet. If you're playing no limit and you put in, like, $200, that guy has to look at $200, which means it might freeze him off it. If you can, change it to chips. I've never played with anybody who's just playing with straight cash. It seems weird, and you would change the chips as soon as you can, but it was in the book that if they're playing with cash, get that shit changed over, because you don't want people thinking about, like, shit, I'm wasting, you know, I'm risking $300 on this. You want them just putting those chips in. It looks the same as any other, just give different colored chips. Also, no booze, because you have to be observant the whole time. Now, also, do not play if you are upset. If you are upset and you're going to play, listen to the Car Wash song a couple of times or something, Chris. Don't play if you're mad, because all of this and our whole strategy is based on patience. Don't play if you're upset. And if somebody at that table is upset and you can see them being upset, try to get in the hands with that guy, because that person is playing emotionally and you might be able to take all their money off them, because they are not thinking about hand selection. They're thinking about something else, which isn't your problem. The same way that, like, don't go in upset about some sort of, in the book they talk about any sort of divorce problems, anything like that. Doyle Brunson in the book was like, yo, maybe take time off, maybe quit the game altogether. Because he talks about how he's seen people blow fortunes based on interpersonal problems because they can't go to the table and get that shit out of their head. If you're in a bad mood, don't play. And if you see somebody else in a bad mood, huffing and puffing, not looking at their cards, rolling their eyes, checking their phone, try to get in hands with that guy because he's not thinking. Seems a little aggressive, but this is what we're going with, dude. All right. So now that you know not to play if you're upset, number one rule here, Chris, when we sit down at this table, the one thing we are not going to be is a calling station. Okay, this is easy money. You did not get invited into this game to just kind of pitter-pat your money away calling other people's bets. Both Bobby Baldwin and Doyle Brunson hit home on this. Calling station is the worst shit to be. You'll lose your money. You make nobody think about how you're going to play. Everybody just sees what you are. They register you as a calling station, and they move their attention to a better player that they have to worry about to try to game to get their money off you. They don't have to worry about you if you're a calling station. They know you're either going to fold, or if you have something, you'll call, because you're never going to push the action. You're not playing aggressively. You're active, but you're passive, and you're not a problem at the table if you're a calling station. The number one thing I wouldn't want to be in this game, if I play with Chet, do not be a calling station, dude. If you're going to bust out hard, okay? Do not sit there and just be passive calling station. It's not dynamic. Nobody has to think about you. You're not a factor at the table. Now, you could play as a tight player, but that's not what we're going with. A tight player is a guy who only plays aces or kings, the absolute highest level. It takes a ton of patience, but the trade-off here is that you're a tight player, and the rest of the table is going to be watching you the same way you're watching the rest of the table to try to get a read on your emotional state. See if you're on tilt. See if you're fucked up. Also, that's slang. Tilt is if you're playing emotionally. The rest of the table will be watching you. So if you're a tight player and you play tight for a couple hours, I don't know how long this game's going to go, they'll see that you're a tight player, and then you'll have a hard time making any pots you're in worth anything, because everybody at the table is going to know that, oh, this guy only plays aces, kings, maybe a set of like ace, king suited, something like that. This guy's never bullshitting. And so it's going to be hard for you to be able to get a pot going, because every time they see you call or raise, they'll know that you're not full of shit. And they won't want, if they don't have a great starter hand too, they're not going to come up against you. That'll put you in a situation where you can't make money, and the only hands you're going to be going up against are other monster hands that other dudes catch. So tight is not how we're going to be playing this. Also, loose is not how we're going to be playing this either. This is the opposite of a tight player. very open about hand selection. You play all sorts of fucking garbage. That's not what we're going to be doing. This is the number one way I would embarrass myself trying to play at that game, is if I'm playing a bunch of rags and speeding around, acting like I know shit. Nope, I'd rather be a tight player than a loose player. At least you kind of look like you think you know what you're doing as a tight player. It would crush me if I was a loose player, just busted out and had to leave and then go into work the next day and have Chip tell everybody how I played. I don't want that. You're not playing a loose play. Don't be a loose player. You're just a mess then. You're not going to keep any of your money. Also, you're not very, if you're just a loose player, dude, nobody's going to be able to read you. Nobody's going to take any time with you. They'll just outplay you. You'll get pegged as a dude who you can just get outplayed, which is also, if you're in a game with a loose player, this is how you beat him. You just outplay him. You can't bluff a loose player or a drunk, which in the book, synonyms at some point. Doyle Brunson's like, you're either going to get a really loose guy who loves action, or you'll get a hammer dude who loves action, or it'll be the same guy. Either way, if you got a loose player at the table, don't try to bluff him. You can't bluff somebody who doesn't know where the fuck they are. You have to tell them where they are in the hand and then explain where they are and then also lie to them. You can't, don't waste your time bluffing a drunk or a loose player. You just got to outplay them. Now, the type of player we are looking to be is a solid player. And this is what we're going with here. And this is why hand selection is so important for us during Operation Chip. Now, a solid player is judicious with hand selection, but once a decision has been made to play a hand, and we decide to get in a hand, we're playing that as aggressively as possible. We are betting and betting and betting and betting. We are not calling. We will throw a hand away if we feel like we're beat, but we're not going to let anybody back us off that hand. I forgot this was part of that book, that it's just aggressive. Now, you can't be as aggressive in limit hold'em because you're only looking at like $4 increments, $8, whatever your limits are. You can only back a guy off a hand that much. If you're in no limit, you can put a dude to a decision for all his chips if you got him beat chip stack wise, or you can put all your chips in. The leverage you have in no limit, if you're a solid player, that's what we're going with. Hypothetically, if we're showing up to a no limit game at Chip's place with all his friends, we are looking to be a solid player and we are looking to play very few hands. But when we get in there, we are throwing money around to make people bail on that shit. Because if we can't win it with straight up cards, we want to try to force them the fuck out with no limit. If you have enough chips, you could try to put other players to a decision for all their chips as much as possible to scare them off, unless they're holding the nuts, which is the best hand possible. If somebody flops the nuts on you and they're holding the highest level flush draw ever, and you go at them like that, that's a bad beat, dude. It's fine. The guy flopped the nuts. They flopped the best hand possible. You went up against him. There's no shame in that. Even if chip sees you get beat, you got beat. Somebody flopped the nuts. Nothing you could do about that. We are looking to be a solid player because it's our best way to maintain aggressiveness at the table, so we're not a calling station. People have to pay attention to the moves we make, which means they're thinking about our game, not thinking about their game, and we can put them on their heels whenever we want, and we can pick up pots that people don't have the nuts to see all the way down. Because when we have good hand selection, you can play it aggressively at every turn because nobody knows what you have. We'll get into hand selection in a second, but if you play everything aggressively, they're gonna have to guess on what you got, and more often than not, they'll just fucking leave. If it's no limit, you're making them if you put them to a decision for all their chips, they're gonna back out unless they know they can win it. And what you're looking to do is make them question whether or not they're willing to risk all the money on their table the rest of their night on this one hand every time you bet. And you're gonna be throwing money out there when it's time because you're a solid player. You're not in there with trash hands. You're not a loose player, and you're also not a tight player. So the people playing against you know that, like, fuck, I don't know what he has. He's not a tight player. He's not a loose idiot, though. He's got something. I don't know whether or not I'm willing to risk all of the money I have right now and the rest of my night on what this guy's saying. And that's where you want them. You want them making difficult decisions. You don't want to be the guy making difficult decisions. You want to be aggressive, and you want to make him have to think about your aggressiveness to be able to make a decision for the rest of his checks for the rest of the night. That's what we're going for. That's why we're trying to be a solid player. Now, when you sit down, the shit you're going to try to be looking for, all the players, but especially watch Chip on this one, to get a read on what type of player he was. Just real quick, you're going to be watching everybody at the table during that first half hour where you set your phone timer, where you try not to play. How many hands does everybody play? How do they bet when they're in a hand? Or do you have any calling stations at the table? Does anybody bluff? Can anybody be bluff that you've seen? Does anybody have a good knowledge of the game, or are there outwardly weak players that are checking up hand strength on their phone? You can take note of that. Is anybody thrown off? Did anybody get a bad beat and now they're on tilt and they're emotional? Take note of that. Try to get in the hands of that guy. That guy's losing his mind. Stay calm. Take all of his money. Also, do you see anybody change up play? Because when you're not playing, in the book it says that's the number one time where you're going to gather data and information on this game you're sitting at. When you're not involved, when you fold a trash hand, that doesn't mean you can chill and check your phone. That's when it's time to watch every step of betting from everybody else around the table. How are they betting? Are they call? Are they raising? Are they check raising? Is somebody acting like they don't have shit? Is somebody just trying to give free cards away? We'll get into free cards in a second. But overall, that's what you're going to be watching everybody on the table, try to get a read on how they are as a player. And we're looking to play strong hand strong, dude. With the exception being when it's time to change gears. Now, you can't just play strong hand strong the whole time. Even if you're playing all night, you're doing well, you're going to have to switch up your play, because the same way that you're watching everybody to see if they suck or what they're doing or how they are, they tight or they loose, everybody else at that table is watching you. So every now and then, you got to throw in some junk. You got to fuck your play up somehow. You don't play a 9-2 offsuit, you play it the exact same as you were holding kings or aces or ace kings. Now, do you show it down? I don't know. In my opinion, I think this is in the book too. I'm not really sure, but like I don't know if I read this 12 years ago or what, but like, don't ever show your cards unless you have to. Because you're giving away information to the table. If anybody else is a knowledgeable player at that table and they're taking into account what you're doing, how you're doing it, if you have an option to muck your cards, which means somebody else showed a higher hand than you and given their position that like they were forced to show first, because everybody shows hands down at the end to the left of the dealer. The position stays the same the whole time. If somebody shows a higher hand than you and you make it all the way down to the river card and there's five cards there and you got to show down, if somebody shows a hand that's better than yours, muck your hand if you can. Some people get pissed about this, like you have to show. As far as I'm concerned, I'm pretty sure that like if somebody else shows, you always have the option to muck your hand, which if you can do that at a game where everybody's watching, muck your fucking hand. Do not give anybody any information that they don't pay to see. If they don't pay to see your cards at the end, do not show them to them for free. Because they're going to take that. Maybe you tried some shit. Did you try to bluff? They know how, if you had a pair of sevens and you tripped up the seven, they'll see how you played that and they'll memorize that. And if you're doing an 8-hour game, or maybe this is your regular game, they can they keep tabs on what you do, how you do, when you do it. All right. Man, this is running long as shit. Let's blow through the last part here. All right. Why, and we're playing hand strong. Why do we play hand strong? A couple of reasons, like big pairs or ace king here. Let's say I have something like that and the flop comes out, your hand's still strong. Why do we play them strong? Why do we lead with a bet? Why don't we just let people put money in there or whatever else and just collect it at the end? Because we can still get beat even with a big pair or ace king and we catch something on the flop. So we play those strong to be able to get as much money in as early as possible. Like a high pair on the flop, it's not a bad thing to win a small pot with it, because aside from betting and getting a lot of money in there and maybe winning a pot if nobody else wants to chase a draw, because if you have a big pair and the flop comes down, you're probably up against a couple different draws or another big pair but you have him dead to rights. What you're going to be scared of are the straight draws and the flush draws that may come out, and they might take all the money from you. So if you have a pair of aces, pair of kings, flop comes out, play it strong, because one, you're getting some money in there. So if the draws don't come out and they want to pay to see the fourth card and the fifth card, you got to make them pay to see those cards. No free cards. No free cards, especially if you're going up against draws. You got ace, you got king. Make them pay something. Don't, and this is in the book. If you lead pre-flop with a bet and you bet, do not check on the flop. You got to follow that up, because if you check on the flop, it gives somebody else, regardless of what they have, they have the ability to take the aggression away from you in that hand. You want to lead. If you're a solid player, we are looking to lead every hand we're in. We're not looking to bet pre-flop and then check and be like, hey, maybe we'll see a fourth card. You're leading that betting. You're leading on 4th Street. And at one point in time, Dora Brunson in the No Limit section is like, yo, even if you play trash cards and you miss everything on the flop, you got nothing. If some dude bets at you and you bet pre-flop, and some guy bets at you, and you should muck down that hand. Throw that hand away. Not going to make any money. If he bets at you, Dora Brunson was like, sometimes I'll just fucking play back at him. I'll just bet right back at him, because I'm not going to let him take control of the aggressiveness of this card game. So if he wants to bet at me, even if I got rags, I got nothing, if I bet pre-flop and he comes at me, I may take it down and go see another card and then fold on 4th Street just to let him know that you can't back me off on a flop, because especially in no-limit hold'em, it's all position and people. I mean, I can't really explain it because I'm not Dylan Brunson. I can't really explain it that well, but especially in the no limit section of this book, when it's time to play no limit, it's all about aggression and intimidation. The cards are important, but the way Dylan Brunson says it is like, and we'll get to how he makes money no matter what in just a second. All right, so you want to play on the flop, strong pair, you want to play it strong. One, you're getting the money in there. Two, you're getting the other hands out of there. And if somebody's got a straight draw, somebody's got a flush draw, get the fuck out of here. Because that will beat your pair if you're trying to see it all the way down. And even if it doesn't beat your pair, you do want to make them pay it for the privilege to see fourth card and fifth card if they're going to beat you. All right, we already covered the aggressiveness. All right. Okay, so just general rules here. Bobby Baldwin says play solid up front and loose around back, which has to do with table position. So the stronger your position is, or the more early you are, the stronger your starting hand has to be. So if you're in first or second position, where like you're the first or second act, you really got to have a strong hand. And the reason you have to have, in regards to your position, you have to have a strong hand is because the other seven dudes are after you. If you're one or two, the rest of the table has to go around and bet. So if you're going to come in on a hand on one or two or early in position, it has to be a solid hand because you might get raised and re-raised behind you, and you don't want to throw money in the pot for no reason. So if you come in early in position, make sure it's a heater of a hand, or know that you're changing gears and playing total junk. But in general, Bobby Baldwin, play solid up front, loose around back, which means when you're close to the dealer position, lay position, you kind of loosen up a little bit. Even a limit, which is Bobby Baldwin's specialty, because you can apply pressure based upon the order of betting. If you're the last to bet, you don't like how everybody limped in, checking around, trying to get a free card, you can throw a bet out there, make everybody pay for the privilege to come down to 4th Street with you. Late position, even in limit, you can still alter the game significantly. So, but especially in no limit, where you can just make people drop the fuck out if you're betting last, dude. You can put in all of your chips last and be like, no free cards. All of your money in to see the next card. Also, as far as play solid up front, loose around back, that sentiment's echoed by Doyle Brunson, because he says you got to gauge it by the table atmosphere. So if the table itself is tight, you're going to try to shade your game loose. If the table itself is loose, you're going to try to shade your game tight, but just quietly. You got to gauge the table vibe, though. All right. Real quick, big hand versus big draw. I'm going to blow through this. It can't be like an hour and a half poker one. I got a shitload of notes left. We're going to get this through. All right. Here we go. You make it to, we already went over big hand, big draw here. That's what you'll be looking at a good amount of the time. If you make it to the flop and you say you played aces, you played kings, you played ace, queen, whatever else, you got a decent sized pair, but you're looking at the board and there's straight options, there's flush options out there. It's your call how you want to play this. And it's based upon your feel of the table. Do you think other guys have straight draws, flush draws? Do you think everybody has nothing? What are you going to do? In the book, if you have a high pair, Doyle Brunson does say sometimes you win a small pot with it and you'd be happy with that. You throw a fat bet down on the flop. You don't want to play with this anymore. You don't have anybody else draw out on you, because it's possible to be able to hit a flush or a straight draw. Now, just real quick, if you're the other side of that equation, and let's say you played a couple of connecting cards, you're looking for a straight draw, looking for a flush draw, looking to make that happen and fuck somebody up who has a big pair, thinks they have the game won. Now, your overall odds, if you're looking at a flush draw from the flop, so let's say you got two diamonds, and you got two diamonds on the board, and there's two more cards to come, 4th Street, 5th Street. The chance that you're going to catch a diamond and make your flush by the end of that hand is about 35% of the time. You got nine outs, nine other diamonds in the deck. You're looking at about one, a little better than one out of three, that by the time all those cards are out, you're going to catch that flush, which is what you're going for. If you're looking for a straight draw, it's a little bit less. With two cards to go, you got about a 31.5% chance with eight remaining outs. Now, going off that math, if you're looking for what's the percentage chance you're going to hit whatever card you're looking for after the flop, every card that's an out for you that you think will win the hand for you, if you're looking for, if you got a pair of kings and you're looking for two more kings to fall because you're looking, you're hoping for quads, is every king is 4%. But it's even less 4% at the flop to the river because it's 2% each. Anyway, nine cards for a flush draw, 35% of the time. 8 cards for a straight draw, you're looking at 31% of the time. 1 out of 3, you're going to make one of those and hopefully win the pot. Now, one thing they do say in the book is that if you are going to play a draw hand, and sometimes a draw hand can be better than a hand you already have made because it's possible to have a straight draw and a flush draw hand, and Doyle Brunson says play those like they're already made hands. He actually says that for a lot of shit, especially in No Limit. Doyle Brunson pretty much just has one speed, which is like, yo, hand selection, and when you're in there, solid player, means you are throwing money around. Make other people make difficult decisions is what I can glean from Doyle Brunson's overall strategy of poker. Which I would hope that I would remember to do if I ever played cards and chips. But it would seem like, all right, I'm going to be kind of a dick here, but this is how we're playing, dude. Let's go. And I would just wait and bet as hard as you can. All right, so that's, one more thing. If you're looking for a draw hand, make sure it's the best draw possible. Don't draw to, like, the low end of a straight or the low end of a flush. Try to make sure that you're drawing to what's known as the nut flush or nut straight, which is the highest possible straight or flush out there. So in the event that your 1 out of 3 chance does come out, you don't get submarined by somebody who is drawing to a higher flush or a higher straight. If you're gonna chase a draw on 4th and 5th Street, try to make sure that you're chasing it to the highest possible, the nut straight or the nut draw. So if you get there, you know you won. All right, real quick, No Limit play. God be with you. All right. Above all else, we are looking to be aggressive and decisive here. And no matter what, we are going to have to gamble. All right. Position and chip stack, almost as important as the cards you're dealt here because of the leverage you can assert. Assert. Again, if you're in dealer position, you're the last person to act. Nobody knows what cards you have. You could put all of your money in the middle and make everything difficult for everybody at any point in time. Careful, but also, how much fun does this sound like, huh? If you're sitting down with your boss and his friends who don't know you, holy shit, how fun would that be? If I found out they were playing No Limit Hold'em, I would say a rosary and know that I might be leaving that house in 10 minutes because I would try hard to play a disciplined game, but like, how much fun does that even sound like? All of my money. I'm all in. Anyway, so real quick, No Limit play. Position is what you're looking for because it's all leverage. You're going to go with same. We're trying to be a solid player here still. Just ramp that up to 10. Again, if you're going to go in, you're going as aggressive as you can. Nothing really changes except for now you're looking to make people make the ultimate decision. If you have somebody leverage where you would raise, now you can make. Doyle Brunson specifically says what he's trying to do is make a man have to make a decision for all his chips as often as possible. The more you do that, the more a guy is not going to be able to chill at a card table because every 10 minutes he has to decide whether or not he's going to play for another hour. Because is he going to buy back in? How much more money does he have? The quicker you can intelligently and aggressively put somebody to a decision for all of the money they have at the table is what we're looking to do here. And we do that with solid hand selection. All right. Did I miss anything? And No Limit suitor connector cards become more favorable. Oh, Doyle Brunson's No Limit strategy. Now, I remember trying to play this in high school and like everybody kind of knew about it because we all bought the same book. But I guess people still know about this strategy. But this was Doyle Brunson's strategy to win a ton of cash games before he published this book in 78. And it's still applicable. So, in No Limit, what Doyle Brunson would do is that he would always want at least as many checks or chips in front of him as the highest guy at the table had. And so, what he would be looking to do is that he'd say he would bet at the big pots and try to win them, but he would always try to scoop up the little pots. So, here's how he would do this. So, we're playing No Limit. He's got at least one of the biggest stacks on the table, and in doing that, he can assert dominance over the table because he can put anybody in for all their chips at any point in time. So when there's a small hand, he said, especially at like a shorthanded table, where instead of doing 9 people, let's say it's later in the night, it's only me chipping like 5 other people. So it's like shorthanded, 7-handed, 5-handed, whatever. Aggression is what you're doing here. You can win small pots. You win that early 15 bucks we covered at the beginning of this. The annies, the small blind, the big blind. That's still 15 bucks, dude. And in a shorthanded game where there's only 5 players, everybody's going to catch shit. Everybody's going to miss a lot. So what Doyle Brunson would do is he would know he had one of the highest stacks at the table, and he would bet at pots. He would just bet at him. Just pre-flop, just betting at him. Sometimes he would get called on it, but a lot of the time he wouldn't. So he would be pocketing that $15 automatic money if he couldn't find anybody else in a shorthanded game, or even sometimes in like a full no-limit hold'em game. He would just go ahead and scoop up those antes, and he would slowly increase his bet size, slowly increase his chip stack, slowly increase it. So when it came down to play and gamble for the big pots, it was almost like he was using that little money that nobody even really thought of. He was just stealing everybody's blinds and antes. So now when it's time for him to have a flush draw out on something where he's like 35% on it, he can afford to gamble because he's paid for this privilege to gamble by sucking up all those antes for 4.5 hours that nobody was even paying attention to. Nobody just wants to go against Doyle because he's got a huge stack. He has a reputation that he'll put your ass in for all your money if you come at him. And their cards aren't that good. So I will let this ante go. Doyle Brunson would do that for like 4 or 5 hours. And then when it would be time to play for a large hand, it was a free roll to him, which is a free roll is when if he wins, great. If he doesn't win, who gives a shit? It was a free roll anyway. I was playing with the house money. He would be playing with other people's money by the time it's time to actually take a shot at a pot. And one of the things he said is that he would never have zero outs. He would take gambles. He'd see cards down, take a long distance flush draw, but he would always want an out just in case. So if he got in a situation like this where he would be willing to gamble, he would have a chance to win the pot. And that made for some of the most spectacular wins he ever had. And it made for his reputation of people being like, damn, dude, Doyle hit it again. He got lucky again. It's like, Doyle Brunson of the book's like, no, it's not lucky. You don't understand. Like, I'm playing those big pots for free because I'm quietly stealing everybody's money on hands nobody's paying attention to. So by the time I got to stake up $20,000, I've already made 31 on antes over the last 2 weeks, so I can afford to take a flyer for $20,000. And That's how the aggression plays back into it. And it all feeds into each other. So you're aggressive, so you're a solid player, so you can push people off. You don't get pushed around in a pot. And when you push enough people around in a pot, you steal all their antes, so then you get to play the big hands for free. This all sounds really easy. It definitely is not. It's so difficult to keep your cool. I would probably freak out if I went to go play with Chip. But this would be what I would want to listen to. This would be a longer commute than I would have. I think it would only be like 40 minutes driving over there. But still, episode 66. Did I miss anything? Nope. Oh, okay, just real quick. Overall advantages to aggressive play. If we haven't hit this home again. Aggressive play advantages. 1, if another player has something, you will know right away and you'll be able to get off your hand, because if somebody has been frustrated and folding at your hand at your bets pre-flop and you've been stealing antes all night, you'll be able to tell when somebody else has a heater. Because they'll come in and they'll bet at you because they've been waiting to fuck you up all night. Because they've been watching you steal their antes. So that's fine. It'll tell you immediately, like, oh, time to get off this one. So you don't waste any money. That's 1 advantage of aggressive play. 2, it allows you to stay healthy by mopping up that junk that we talked about. If you collect the antes, you collect the blinds, you got some free rolls later on in the game if you want to gamble a little bit. 1 more thing before we go. In the event that you show up and it's tournament play, everything's the same. Slow it on down, though. That's the only difference. Is that, let's say for the first half hour, you're just going to study people. Let's bump that out to 45 minutes. And let's not get involved in any hands for an hour or so if we can really help it. Because the only thing they say in tournament play is that you're still playing solid, judicious hand selection, but you just don't get your head blown off early. Just don't sit down and be one of these people that are in the first like 4 or 5 hands, and then you're busted out. And then what are you going to do? You're going to go home? But in the event that you do bust out early, it did say in the book that like one of the advantages to busting out early in a tournament is that if there was, let's say there's 20 dudes, you got a couple tables going, if enough people bust out and you stick around, there'll be some pretty healthy side games, cash games on the side that you might want to be able to get into. So maybe don't storm away. If you get a bad beat, you get taken out on a tournament, hang out, wait for 8 or 9 other dudes to get busted out, start a cash game going, see how that's going. Have a fun night. Anyway, guys. Episode 66. What the fuck did I even name this one? Some sort of shit talk at Chip. Episode 66, How to Bust Up Chip's Card Game by Doyle Brunson. I doubt Chip's going to hear this. He might. Chip, if you want to extend an invite, I no longer work for you. And I will cut you in on this strategy. We can betray all of your friends. We'll make a strategy and we'll just betray all of them. All right. Have a good week, guys. I'll be back with Patreon later on. And thank you for listening. I'll talk to you guys later on. I'll see you.